listening to the Canoe Holic Order, episode 28 for season 13, on day 188 of 2019. Hey everybody, this is Klaatu. You've already heard the story. I've moved house down to the South Island of New Zealand. It's really beautiful here. It almost snowed. Didn't quite snow, but it almost snowed today, which is really one of the reasons we moved down here. We rather like snow. So, maybe tomorrow, who knows? I don't have my stuff yet still. The moving company that I contracted to bring the things that wouldn't fit into the car didn't hit their mark of delivering our stuff to us. So I am still on just my work laptop. Now that doesn't actually mean, and I didn't mean to imply, I'm not sure if I did in the previous episodes, that I couldn't talk about Yuta Linux because I didn't have my Slack box on me. Because Yuta Linux, as I've said, is probably on, I mean, it's certainly on your Linux computer, unless you've got a very niche Linux computer, you definitely have Yuta Linux on there. So that's not what's been keeping me from talking about Yuta Linux. It's just been time, the time to sit down and look at the next command that we're going to go over and so on. So this week has been a little bit more normal for me. So we're going to keep going with Yuta Linux. That's the long and short of it. And keep going. So there's fallocate is the command that I wanted to cover, or at least one of the commands that I want to cover today. See if we get farther than that. And the thing that may delay things is that I want to talk a little bit about Flatpak again, which I know I've talked about a lot lately, but a use case has arisen, or at least a shining example of why Flatpak is useful. Flatpak and Snap, for that matter. In fact, in this particular case, probably Snap more than Flatpak. And it was with Dave Morris's fix tags. You may remember in the previous episode, Dave Morris from Hacker Public Radio had emailed me about a little Perl script that he'd written called fix tags, and I vowed to try it. And furthermore, I took him up on his challenge of trying to install it. Now, coincidentally, I'd been looking for a good example, like a really just a stellar example of why the isolation of Flatpak and Snap packages is beneficial, because it's actually a bizarrely hard sell. A lot of people are strangely resistant to Flatpak and Snap. They seem to think that there's some sort of sanctity of the way that Linux distributes its packages, and if you dare come up with an alternative method, then you are somehow making Linux less Linux, which to me is bizarre. But I tried installing fix tags, which, again, to be fair, Dave Morris warned me. In fact, I mean, I playfully took it as a challenge because he warned me. He said, difficult to install this stuff. So I started installing fix tags. And it wasn't hard at first. I thought, well, this is not as hard as he imagined it would be. I'm just using Perl and CPAN and installing things locally and pulling a couple from my software repository. I don't know if you've used CPAN much, dear listener. It's a little bit like Python pip, which is a little bit like yum or apt. It's a package management system specifically for Perl, CPAN is. Well, CPAN is also a repository, but they also distribute a tool called CPAN, or actually I think the package name you'll find in your repository is CPAN minus. And so I installed CPAN minus and started using CPAN. There was another way to use it too. There was used to be just a straight Perl command you could run, but lately they've just got CPAN as the command. It's pretty handy. And you do CPAN and you install the module as provided to you in whatever list of dependencies or requirements that you're reading. And it goes to CPAN, finds the module, and installs it. And it even gives you an option to install it either locally, just within your home directory, or system-wide, and so on. So it's really, really handy. It's really useful. And it makes using getting the Perl modules just a breeze. Now, some modules, of course, will be in your software repository, so you can just install them from there. The problem with that sometimes is that the versions might not be up to date in your repository. Also, the naming scheme is bizarrely confusing in repositories a lot of times, I've found. And CPAN is sometimes just kind of the easier way to go. But it depends on I guess how much you use Perl and so on. And CPAN, actually, I should mention, it'll append some entries into your .bashrc file so that Perl knows where to look for these locally installed modules. And you'll want to you'd want to source your .bashrc file if you do that, because you need to bring that into your current environment. CPAN does not do that for you. So, very useful, very easy. Got 9/10 of the way there with CPAN. And then there was one library, like Audio Tag Lib, I think. And he gives a warning about it, so he calls that one out specifically. And sure enough, that was the one that killed it for me. I could not get the correct version of Tag Lib installed because the Perl module relies on a C++ library, and the C++ library, at least on RHEL 7, because I haven't updated to RHEL 8 because I've been moving, is too old, so I was trying to yank out Tag Lib from RHEL 7, but it didn't want to let me do that because there were GStreamer relies on Tag Lib, and so if I removed that, I would have to remove GStreamer, and if I removed GStreamer, I'd have to remove, I don't know, the kernel. Stupid stuff like that, right? And it kind of occurred to me as I was doing all of this that this was the thing I'd been looking for. This is the use case. This is the example. This is the reason. This is the thing that you can point to when someone says, why do we need Flatpak? Why do we need Snap? That's not how we've done it for 20, 40, 80 years, so who cares about this stuff? Point them to fixed tag. I don't know that Dave Morris wants his little Perl scripts to be the poster child for containerized installation of applications, but I mean, it is a really great example. A simple little Perl script that just happens to rely on this little tiny C++ library that nobody thinks about, nobody cares about, and yet is apparently the thing that makes your computer run. I mean, it is as important as the kernel itself. I'm being hyperbolic here just to make a point, but it's 2019. It shouldn't take hours. It shouldn't take someone to go into RPM or, you know, whatever package system you're using. It shouldn't take you to rebuild your RPM packages and recompile all of the dependencies in order to get this fixed tag or this tag lib thing installed so that I can then install fixed tag. It's just not, first of all, nobody else has to do that, right? It's 2019. Nobody's doing this. Nobody should be doing this. Second of all, it's just not that important, right? I mean, this is on the list of things I want to spend my time on. Fixing metadata tags with a Perl script is not, it doesn't even rank. It's not on the playing field at all. It's not even there. So in other words, it is possible to do the thing, but it just doesn't warrant any more than a click or a quick command to have it happen. That if you have to work for a fixed tag or for audio tag lib or whatever, then it's already not worth it, right? It is just such not an important thing in your computing experience. And so, do you really, we don't want Linux to, just the complexity of installing a library on Linux, which should not be complex, by the way, and not wouldn't be complex on all systems, right? I'm sure if I had my stock or a laptop, I could do this in no time. We'll find out, right? When I get my stuff, I think they're supposed to arrive tomorrow with my precious computers. So the complexity of installing a library in some given instance should not be the deciding factor on whether you get to try out this little frivolous application that on a whim you thought you might try because you had a spare 10 minutes. Well, if it takes you an hour to figure out how to get the audio library installed, then that 10 minutes is gone six times over. Not good, right? That's not the state we want our favorite operating system to be in. especially right now. This is a problem that has been solved. It should have been solved. It should have been solved probably a long time ago, and Flatpak and Snap are the solutions. So if anyone ever asks, point them to Fix Tags and just tell them to go install that, and they'll understand why. Now, if they cheat and they use, I don't know, something like Fedora 30, then everything, or the latest thing, I should say, then yeah, things are going to work. I get it. I get that if you keep up with all the latest developments, then you'll never have any problems. I mean, until you do, of course. But you won't have compatibility issues, and that's a wonderful state to be in. That's really cool that some people have that, have the luxury, let's say, to run a completely unstable environment. But I don't think that's also, again, that's not what we want our favorite operating system to be, I don't think. I don't think we want to insist. Well, no, you have to keep up with development in order to have a valid running environment. It's just all of these things are the opposite of what Linux is supposed to be. Linux is supposed to be the one that is flexible and that you can do anything with, and no matter how trivial your interest is or the thing that you want to do, no matter how trivial it is, if you have Linux, you can do it on there. If it's just that important for you to have, I don't know, use the old cliche, to have Comic Sans as your terminal font, then you should be able to do that on Linux, right? Everything should be possible on Linux. So if you can't get something installed on it in 10 minutes, then that's a problem that needs to be addressed. Flatpak, Snap packages, those are them. So I think Fix Tags may literally—I don't know—I haven't looked at the complexity of making a Flatpak or a Snap package with Perl libraries installed. I mean, that's a whole new sort of—that's a whole ball of wax that I haven't really dealt with all that much. I mean, I've done a little bit here and there maintaining Perl-related packages, but not a whole. I don't know Perl well. I've been meaning to know Perl better. Dave Morris, whether he knows it or not, taught me awk, and it's changed my life. So I do want to kind of look at Perl. The problem with Perl for me is that I don't know whether I should be learning Perl 5 or 6. I can't get a good read on what the community is saying about that or where it's all going to go. And I don't want to be the sucker to spend a year or 10 years learning Perl 5 only to find that everyone was actually looking at Perl 6 all along. But anyway, that's what I wanted to say about Flatpak and Snaps. I want to encourage you to look at those systems as things that can provide greater flexibility for Linux, and I think that's a very, very good thing. Okay, that's my discussion about Flatpak and Snaps. I think we should have a coffee now, fallocate afterwards. You'll understand that in a moment. So what is fallocate? I mentioned it cryptically before the coffee break. Well, it's the next command. It's the next command in Yodel Linux. This is a tough one to demonstrate because the commands sort of that one would normally use to demonstrate certain principles about file sizes are pretty smart. They are all too smart, or they're all too dumb because fallocate is lying to them. Well, fallocate isn't lying to them, but sparse files are. So fallocate, very, very simply, I think I've actually used it on this show with Yodel Linux discussions, I think. I think I was talking about, I don't remember which one I was talking about actually, but I mean, at some point I used fallocate to create a file of a certain size. That was a very specific thing that we needed to do at some point. I don't exactly remember all the reasons. And I used fallocate. I don't think I knew at the time that it was actually in the Udo Linux package, but it is. So the really, really simple way to use fallocate is to type fallocate, F-A-L-L tab, and then do dash dash length, and we could say, I don't know, 256, and we'll name it foo. And then if I do an ls-lh on foo, it tells me that that file exists and that it is exactly 256 bytes. Of course, if I cat foo, it's empty. It's a completely empty file. So this is a file that does exist, but is empty. I've simply told the file system, hey, I want to allocate 256 bytes to this file called foo. Is it any different than touch? Technically, yes. Does just touching an empty file call fallocate? I don't know for sure. I kind of bet it does, but I haven't looked at the source code to know for sure. Very similar, if not the same. Now, fallocate can kind of mess around with how it's allocating data. And there's this whole concept of sparse files, which you might have heard of these. It's pretty popular. I think it was made popular. Maybe it was developed for all I know. I don't know. But it seemed to come to the forefront with virtual machines, because you would create a virtual hard drive, and for the virtual hard drive, you would think, okay, well, I need, I don't know how much I need, but I could need 100 gigabytes for this virtual machine, or 50 gigabytes, I don't know, whatever, let's say 50. And so you might make a virtual machine that's 50 gigabytes, but usually what's happening, and sometimes it's depending on the interface that you're using, it'll prompt you, it'll ask. But a lot of times what it's actually happening is it's making a sparse 50 gigabyte file, meaning that it has written some metadata at some places, saying that it's sort of putting a reserve on 50 gigabytes. It's not actually using 50 gigabytes of the file system. It's simply speaking for 50 gigabytes of the file system. But until it actually writes data to those places in the file system, it's not actually used up. And I don't know how, the OS mitigates sort of prioritization of allocated space. I don't know how that works. I haven't looked into it at all. I'm definitely out of scope for fallocate anyway. But fallocate can do a little bit of work with sort of the files and whether or not, I guess, they're sparse files. So what I'll do here is I'm going to create a new window here in my terminal. There we go. So the first thing I'm going to do is sudo mount. No, actually, first thing I'm going to do is make dir, sudo make dir, slash mnt slash rd for RAM disk. Okay, so I create that. That makes an empty directory in mount. And then I'm going to, or mmt. So then I'm going to do a sudo mount dash t temp fs dash o dash, nope, dash o size equals, let's do 4k. So we're making a tiny little RAM disk, a little temporary fake disk drive. We've done this before, I think. 4K, so that's just 4,000 bytes, right? And then we're going to use tempfs as the file system type, and then we will do a slash mnt slash rd. So I'm mounting this temporary file system on slash mnt slash rd. That's just going to give us a very restricted place to play in. So it's 4K. All right, so now what we're going to do is we're going to make a file. We're gonna make a file. Let's try this. Let's do an fallocate dash dash length, and we're gonna make it 5,000 bytes, and we'll call it bar. Now, if I copy bar to slash mnt slash rd, I get an error saying that there's no space left on the device. And that's expected because I made a file that's 5,000 bytes and I'm trying to copy it into a file system that is only 4,000 bytes in size. I'm going to do fallocate dash dash dig dash holes space bar. Now if I copy bar into slash mnt slash rd, still get an error. This thing isn't big enough, the file is too big. Okay, so now I'm going to do a copy dash dash sparse equals always bar to slash mnt slash rd, and it succeeds. So there you go. We just copied a 5,000 byte file to a 4,000 byte disk space because the file that was created, or the file that we have copied, is a sparse file. So there's metadata in there somewhere, I guess. I don't know how to look at it. That says, hey, this is a 5,000 byte file, or a 5K file, and yet it fits on a 4K file system. Shouldn't be possible, but it is because of sparse disk images. And so again, if we do copy dash dash sparse equals never on bar and copy that to slash mnt slash rd, it fails because that way you're ignoring the sparsity of the file and you are trying to copy all that literal space over to the file system. That doesn't work. There are other things you can do to get files reduced and so that you can copy things, but you're really talking about getting rid of, yeah, in the context of getting rid of sparse allocated sparse space, fallocate, and I guess truncate come to mind. And it's really something that I think typically you're going to control with your whatever has created that sparse file. That said, you could certainly look into managing your files with sparse, as sparse files. I don't know what the benefit would be to doing that. I'm not really sure why you would want to manage it that way. Fallocate probably is not, in other words, going to be the command that you use in real life. There's rarely a real life benefit that I can think of to pre-allocating space to a certain file. But maybe you've got a use case for it. And there's fallocate in case you do. Next up is FD format, which is the floppy disk formatter. It's a low-level format, a floppy drive, or a floppy disk rather. Now, I do not have a floppy disk or a drive. I did. I mean, I've used them in real life at one point, a long time ago. But that's not something that I've kept up with, so I cannot demonstrate this command. Apparently, it's FD format. Some options which include no verify or the version of the application, and then a path to the floppy disk. And the typical locations of floppy disks would be things like slash dev slash FD 0D360. I don't know why that's the path. I don't know why FD0 and FD1 aren't the things that you would use, but the man page specifically says that FD0 and FD1 fail to work with FD format when a non-standard format is being used. So not too sure. Even I don't even know what formats are available for floppy disks. I don't know. Can you just put in ext4? I guess you probably can. Although I mean, floppy disks are what, like 1.44 megabytes? Is that what it is? I guess that would work. But anyway, I can't really speak too much about FD format because I don't have the tools to explore that command, and I really don't actually intend to get back into floppy disks anytime soon. I know that there is a use for them, just like when I was talking about the zip drives and jazz drives and stuff. You know, retro computing, having an actual floppy drive is probably very useful. And I do remember, I mean, there are floppy drives out there with a USB interface. So, I mean, they were still a thing, like, you know, 2001, 2002, 2003, that time period, when everyone had basically, when everyone was walking away from floppy disks as quickly as they could. It was a weird time, you know, the floppy disks had been around since, I don't know, the early 80s, if not earlier. And, well, yeah, earlier, right? Because they started out as the big ones, the 5.25. And yes, I know you probably have memories. Some of you probably know of even larger ones. But, yeah, the 3.5 ones came out, little sort of coaster-sized floppy disks. And they weren't floppy, they were hard-shelled. And people knew that they were too small. People wanted to get away from them. But there really, bizarrely, wasn't a great solution yet. You know, and it wasn't really clear on what people were going to do for sort of permanent walk-away storage. You had CD-ROMs, but they were impossibly slow. Like, at one point, a CD-ROM drive wrote basically at one speed. It took forever, just absolutely forever. And then I think, obviously, there was the iOmega zip and jazz drives that came out, and people were like, yeah, that could work. That seems reasonable. But there were, I remember there being weird problems with those. Maybe it was a reliability issue. I don't know. I got feedback saying that they were actually pretty good, so maybe I'm just misremembering. But people, that I guess ultimately they just didn't take off the way that they needed to take off. You know, they just weren't, and there were always peripherals too. I mean, there were some computers that would have, that had iOmega drives, and you'd put your jazz or zip disk right into the computer. I don't know if that ever happened on the laptop or not, because they were rather large compared to floppies. They weren't ubiquitous, I guess. And they were very specific to computers, unlike CDs, which were kind of nicely cross, more than cross-platform, cross-market, right? They were good for CD, they were good for, I mean, audio, they were good for data. It was really exciting, but they were slow. And then they weren't really rewritable, and then some of them came out and they were rewritable, but then people were kind of feeling like, yeah, the rewrite stuff. You know what, maybe what I'm remembering about the iOmega stuff is that they were expensive. The media itself was a little bit expensive, and CDs reached a pretty ridiculous kind of cheap price point really quickly, for better or for worse. I mean, they weren't terribly, it's not a great media. People just didn't know what was going to happen between, you know, and given, okay, I can have a floppy disk, I can have a CD, or I can have a special sort of media that needs a special drive in order to work, which, what am I going to do here? And it was a bit of a confusing time. When I remember when thumb drives came out, that was just kind of a breath of fresh air, because it was just, okay, finally we've got a reasonable portable storage solution, finally. It was really looking dismal, at least from my point of view, from about 2001 to 2006-ish, probably. 5 years of uncertainty. Okay, next up is FLOC, or FLOC, which is, it manages locks from shell scripts, or rather, it gives you the ability to manage locks via a shell script, in a shell script. So file system locks are exactly what they really sound like. They are little locks that the system can place on a file so that some other program doesn't grab that file and try to do something with it because it's currently being used. You've probably run into this sometimes, maybe if you've tried to do a software repository command like a yum or an apt or something, and yum or apt is already working in another window, and you try to do something, it'll tell you sometimes, oh, this is, this PID file is locked and unable to continue because something else is using the process, because it doesn't want two things trying to synchronize the repository database at the same time. That would be bad. But flock isn't quite as simple as just placing a lock on a file and then unlocking it later. That's not how it works. It's a bit of a roundabout command. So it's really it is an opt-in lock. So this isn't a lock that actually locks something. This is more. It's less a lock than a speaking as a spoken for, like a designator. Like, oh, you raise your hand. I'm using this right now, so please don't anyone else use this. Other things can use it. So, for instance, if you put a lock, if I do f lock on foo, first that'll fail. F lock foo, bad number foo. Okay, well, exec 200 redirect into foo. And now I'll say f lock dash in for number 200 dash c for the command that I want to issue, that I want to tie this thing up with. And I really can't think of any good command to tie it up with other than just let's do tack. Okay, so now I've got a file sort of hanging open, but in an f lock in my terminal. And if I were to do something, if I were to attempt to do something to this file, you might think, well, you've just done an f lock, so nothing should be able to touch it, right? Well, watch this. Echo equal, or, oops, echo quotation hello, close quote, redirect into foo. Doesn't say it failed, so I'll cancel out of this f lock, control C, and then I'll cat foo. And sure enough, it's got that word echo, the word hello in it. So I had it f locked, but Echo was able to just write to it anyway. That seems not very useful. Well, like I say, it's an opt-in kind of command. So the example in the man page is a little bit com maybe arguably over complex, but we'll do it anyway. We're going to do it make directory temp in my current directory. And then we're going to do flock dot slash temp space dash c tack. So I'm catting, well, I'm tacking the dot slash temp directory, which makes no sense, but it causes the flock to remain in place. So now if I go back over to another terminal and attempt to do the same thing to slash temp, so if I do flock space dot slash temp dash C, and then the way they do it in the man page is they use echo instead of tack, which is fine. And then a semicolon and a slash bin slash echo dollar sign question mark so that we get the error code that we're about to witness. So I'll hit return. Oh, I forgot something. Sorry. Cancel out of that. Flock dash W, which I think, let's look at the man page really quick. Yeah, so it's dash dash wait. So dash dash wait, and then we'll just do something really, really fast. Like, well, no, let's do 1 second, and then dot slash temp dash c echo colon bin echo dollar sign question mark. And then after 1 second, it returns one, which means something went wrong because it's supposed to return zero. So it was unable to place a lock on the slash temp file or the dot slash temp file. So that worked. It's a little bit of a convoluted example, I think, because it doesn't really demonstrate it like you want it to demonstrate. But that, I mean, that is the principle, that if you place an F lock on a file or a directory, and there's different kinds of locks, there's an exclusive lock, there's a what do they call it, a shared lock. One prevents you from reading the thing, one prevents you from writing to the thing. Then another application that you're telling, hey, Don't do this unless the file is available, if it's free. If it's locked, do not proceed. Then they mutually agree that something's spoken for, and they back off as required. And that's what it does, that's F-lock. All right, let's see what else we've got in the F series. Oh, that's it. That's all the Fs. So we're going to stop there because I've got stuff to do to prepare for movers to come tomorrow. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next time. Cast. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network, usually in channels such as Augcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is not Klaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is @Klaatu at mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's klaatu@member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And of course, you can visit my various websites, gnuworldorder.info and slackermedia.info. I will see you next time.
Oh, what's brave in these times? Well, that's too cool.